tens of thousands of Israelis protest the Netanyahu government.
He's the weakest he's ever been.
Police in Haiti, helpless as a crowd, hacked two men to death.
Another terrified woman could be heard saying, "Sweet Jesus, I am going to die today."
And a previously all-boys military school in Ukraine is now teaching girls, too.
For years, only boys could get a military education at the Ivan Bohun Military Lyceum in Kyiv, Ukraine, the alma mater of the country's top Ukrainian military officers. In recent years, however, more girls have joined this elite high school to receive officers' training.
Today is Monday, April 1st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Scott Walterman. Tens of thousands of Israelis protested against the government of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu outside the Parliament building in Jerusalem. It was the largest protest since the start of the war on October 7th. Protesters briefly blocked a highway, built bonfires, and lit up red flares as they called for Netanyahu's government to resign. In other parts of town, reservist protesters marched to an Orthodox neighborhood where they scuffled and got in heated arguments with ultra-Orthodox Jews. The reservists, who are against exemptions granted to ultra-Orthodox Jewish men from military service, want a more equal share in the burden of army service that binds most Israelis. Now, while all this was going on, Netanyahu himself was out of action. He was in the hospital having hernia surgery. That's Netanyahu before the surgery saying, "I assure you, I will get through this treatment successfully and return to action very quickly, very quickly." While under anesthesia, Netanyahu turned control of the government over to a minister. Also on Sunday, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas swore in a new government headed by Mohammed Mustafa, an ally to Abbas and a leading business figure. Mustafa formed a new cabinet on Thursday in which he will also serve as foreign minister. He was appointed premier this month with a mandate to help reform the Palestinian Authority, which exercises limited self-rule in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. He was also given the job of rebuilding Gaza. Let's go deeper on all of this. Joining us to talk about this is Atalia Omer, professor of religion, conflict, and peace studies at the Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies Sociology at Notre Dame University. So I'd like to start with the protests. Tens of thousands of people. These are the biggest anti-government protests, and by anti-government I mean the Netanyahu government, since the start of the October 7th war. What do you think that means?
Yeah, I mean, it means that finally there is consolidation of the forces, or rearticulation of the forces that were out in the streets right before October 7th and for the nine months before October 7th in protest against the judicial coup or the judicial reform, depending who you are. So you see some of the same people are being mobilized, and the main kind of force behind the protests is in reference to the hostages, and really putting pressure on the government to negotiate in good faith for the immediate release of the hostages. So there is a lot of mobilization around this. There is a general sense that Netanyahu is responsible for also the fact that the hostages are not yet released, that this is intentional, that he is trying to hold on to his power. So there is a kind of a broad dissatisfaction with Netanyahu. The demonstration, these anti-government, anti-Netanyahu demonstrations are not mobilized, are not motivated by recognition of the kind of suffering that people in Gaza are enduring, including famine and a total destruction of the infrastructure and healthcare system, and the fact that there is a looming invasion of Rafah. So it's really mobilized by the issue of the hostages and the long, long, long delays in getting any kind of tangible results from the presumed negotiations about the hostages.
It does seem the public opinion is still behind the war. You're right.
Yes.
And just to remind people, something you said is true. Before the October 7th war started, there were weekly demonstrations against the Netanyahu government,
right. primarily
centered around the judicial reforms. But that went away at the beginning of the war. But you're right, these are the same groups coming back together.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And some of them are mobilized around the issue of the exemption of Orthodox, of Haredi people from military service. So part of the people who kind of one of the dimension, kind of the elements within the broader movement, the democracy movement protests before October 7th is specifically focused on the issue of exemption of the Haredi, the ultra-Orthodox for military service, and they are demonstrating, yesterday demonstrated near the very ultra-Orthodox neighborhood, Mea Shearim, in Jerusalem. So there are different kind of issues, but as in the case of the so-called democracy protest before October 7th, there is only a small contingency within that broader movement, the people who are out in the streets, who are also making the connection between the occupation, the issue of the occupation of Palestinians, and the broader issues.
What do you think this actually means for Netanyahu in terms of his longevity?
Yeah, I mean, it's he's the weakest he's ever been, as become very clear now in analysis, and really it's very, very, very evident that he's so weak, and he's been very, very weakened from before October 7th, but of course with the kind of responsibility that most Israelis, even though they are, as you said, in support of the violence against Gazans, they recognize him as ultimately responsible for the failures of October 7th. So he knows that if the movement will grow, will persist, will be sustained like it was before October 7th, that's the end of his political career, and especially with the investigation against him and his corruption case also in the background.
There was also some news out of the Palestinian Authority. The Mohammed Mustafa formed a new government, was already prime minister. Now he'll also be foreign minister and has also been assigned to lead the rebuilding of Gaza. So the Palestinian Authority is moving forward with the post-war, it looks like.
In terms of the perceptions of Palestinians and how Palestinians broadly experience these developments as something that is engineered by the United States and presumably is acceptable to Israel, and it's really kind of an effort to do a facelift to the Palestinian Authority that as is very well known at this point, is profoundly not representative of the Palestinian discourse. It's very delegitimized within kind of the Palestinian street, what it appears to be is a continuation of a long of those years, I mean decades really, of thinking that some sort of like a peace negotiation will involve focusing on economic development. And Mohammed Mustafa is he actually self-defines himself as a technocrat, having a kind of an economic background. So it's very clear that for Palestinians that this is kind of a top-down engineering, trying to revitalize the PA that is completely diminished in terms of its, traction. I mean, Palestinians want, the possibility, the opportunity to have, a real, election, and a democratic discourse to, that will result with their own kind of unified and consensus-based leadership. So kind of the footprints of an American discourse are evident in this move. Meanwhile, the onslaught on Gaza continues.
Thank you so very much for joining us.
Yeah, sure. Thank you for having me.
Professor Talya Omer of Notre Dame University. On Easter Sunday, Pope Francis also got into the discussion of the situation in Gaza. Here's VOA's Arash Erbasadi with that part of the story.
Easter Sunday in Vatican City. Before a packed crowd at St. Peter's Square filled with flowers, Pope Francis delivered a message calling for peace in Gaza.
I appeal once again that access to humanitarian aid be ensured in Gaza and call once more for the prompt release of the hostages seized on October 7th and for an immediate ceasefire in the Strip. Let us not allow the current hostilities to continue to have grave repercussions on the civil population and above all the children.
Calls for aid to Gaza have recently taken shape as a convoy of ships left a port in Cyprus Saturday carrying some 400 tons of food and other relief supplies. World Central Kitchen says the crafts carried ready-to-eat staples like rice, pasta, flour, canned vegetables, and proteins, enough to prepare more than 1 million meals. The United Nations warns that famine could strike northern Gaza as early as this month. The United States military, along with regional partners, continues delivering relief in the form of airdropped pallets filled with food and water. But the deliveries can be spotty at times without any organized distribution method on land. On Sunday, at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem, widely considered the most holy site in Christianity, the Archbishop held Easter Mass in a church emptier than years past, as since October 7th, Palestinian worshipers need special permission to cross checkpoints into Jerusalem. Arash Erbasadi, VOA News.
We're following these other stories from around the world. Ukraine's presidential election, which was scheduled for Sunday, didn't happen, postponed due to the Russian invasion. Most of the country stands behind incumbent President Volodymyr Zelensky. Most observers agree the country is in no position to hold a national election given its need to focus on repelling the Russians. With efforts underway to clean up thousands of tons of steel debris from that collapsed bridge in Baltimore's harbor, Maryland Governor Wes Moore on Sunday urged Republicans to work with Democrats to approve the federal funding needed for rebuilding the bridge and to get the port cleared and open again. The governor said it would affect the American economy the longer the port is closed. Japan says its experts have held talks with Chinese counterparts to try to assuage Beijing's concerns over the discharge of treated radioactive wastewater from the wrecked Fukushima nuclear power plant into the sea. The discharges have been opposed by fishing groups and neighboring countries, especially China, which banned all imports of Japanese seafood. China's move has largely affected Japanese scallop growers and exporters to China. Police in Haiti say two men were hacked to death by a mob who thought they were buying ammunition or guns for gangs that have terrorized the country. Police confirmed that the crowd snatched the men from police custody after they were found with the equivalent of about $63,000 in cash in their car. Police appeared to fire warning shots in the air to prevent the killings, but the mob killed them anyway. One of the victims was a police officer, the other a former guard. The surge in gang violence that has plagued Haiti this month has spread to parts of the capital, Port-au-Prince, where some of its most prominent institutions are located. The violence has shaken residents' sense of security in areas they thought were relatively safe. Here's VOA's Michael Lippin.
Gunfire erupted in the streets surrounding a major public park in downtown Port-au-Prince, Haiti, on March 21st. What is going on? Our reporter asked one of the many people running away from the shooting near the Champ de Mars. There was no answer, but another terrified woman could be heard saying, "Sweet Jesus, I am going to die today." One man, who didn't provide his name, was walking away from the violence when he noticed our reporter's Voice of America insignia. He stopped to share his experience.
There are a lot of rumors going around. I'm here to sell stuff, and I cannot even make a sale. I am now 60 years old. I cannot live under this kind of pressure. I have to leave and go home.
A young man on a motorcycle, bleeding from his leg, stopped to get his wound bandaged by an armed man dressed in black. Uniformed police patrolling the streets shouted for people to leave the area, as others guarded the entrance to a base of UDMO, a Haitian National Police unit responsible for crowd control. The bandits looted and burned other businesses, including one where Jean-Yves Policard says he had been working for 37 years.
I don't know yet how much I've lost. Being so close to the hospital and the presidential palace, I didn't think that I would face this situation.
That absence of security has left residents of the Haitian capital wandering through the wreckage of burned-out cars and debris-filled streets. For Matiado Vilme in Port-au-Prince, Haiti, Michael Lippin, VOA News.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Scott Walterman.
İmam oğlunu ve kıymetli aile çocuklarını Sayın Dilek İmamoğlu'na da ait ediyoruz.
Turks dealt President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and his party their biggest electoral blow on Sunday in a nationwide local vote that reasserted the opposition as a political force and reinforced Istanbul Mayor Ekrem İmamoğlu as the president's chief rival. With most of the votes counted, İmamoğlu led by 10 percentage points in the mayoral race in Istanbul, that's Turkey's largest city, while his Republican People's Party retained Ankara and gained 15 other mayoral seats in cities nationwide. It marked the worst defeat for Erdogan and his AK party in their more than 20 years in power and could signal a change in the country's divided political landscape. Erdogan said early on Monday that his ruling alliance did not achieve the desired result from Sunday's local elections, adding they would carry out self-criticism and address their shortcomings. And finally, more than 2 years into Russia's invasion, Ukraine faces shortages not just of ammunition and equipment, but also soldiers. In response, more Ukrainian women are enlisting in the armed forces, and girls are choosing to pursue training to become military officers. There is one military school in Ukraine which is the most famous and alma mater of most of Ukraine's top military brass. Miroslava Gangadze takes us there.
For years, only boys could get a military education at the Ivan Bohun Military Lyceum in Kyiv, Ukraine, the alma mater of the country's top Ukrainian military officers. In recent years, however, more girls have joined this elite high school to receive officers' training. Lyceum Deputy Commander Dmitro Yarmolenko says that including girls has improved the learning environment.
First, we had only one platoon of girl cadets. It was a new experience for us. And now we have more than 60 cadets, girl cadets. They are very smart and always ready for the new problems, new types of education.
Before the war, positions of women in the army were limited. Now, Yermolenko says, women can serve in a variety of military roles. Lisa Bahny, a former athlete, she chose to pursue a military education.
I love Ukraine and I want to defend it. I want to be a military officer of the Ukrainian army. I want to go to front line. After my studying, I will go.
Bahny's classmate, Bohdana Ternopih, gave us a tour of a girls' quarter, where she learned to keep her things tight and in order. Her brother is fighting on the front line, she says. Her parents supported her decision to apply to military lyceum. She wants to serve her country now that the Ukrainian army has more opportunities for women. She says if you look at 2010-2014, the culture positively changed. Before, men did not accept women in the army. Women used to be cooks, operators, or drivers. Now, there are more women, she says. They are the snipers and gunners. In general, women can choose any fighting role. Captain Svetlana Shemchuk, lyceum educator and overseer of the girls' program. She says what changed is girls got gender equality. Girls can do everything, she adds, and they are even more resilient. According to the Ukrainian Defense Ministry, as of 2024, over 45,000 women were serving in Ukraine's armed forces. While most are in supportive roles, over 4,000 are fighting in the combat zone, showing that Ukrainian women are prepared to endure the hardship of the war in defense of their country. Miroslava Gungadze, VOA News, Kyiv, Ukraine.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you so much for being with us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Scott Walterman.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States has imposed sanctions on Nicaragua's Attorney General, Wendy Carolina Morales Urbina. In a statement, the Treasury Department called her a key actor in the Nicaraguan regime's unjust persecution of political prisoners and civil society within the country. Treasury Undersecretary for Terrorism and Financial Intelligence Brian Nelson said, "The Attorney General, in concert with the Ortega Murillo regime, has exploited her office to facilitate a coordinated campaign to suppress dissent by seizing property from government political opponents without a legal basis. The seizures include the properties of the 222 political prisoners who were released and flown to the United States in February 2023. The exiled Nicaraguans were also stripped of their citizenship. Morales Urbina helped formulate the strategy, designating Nicaraguan opposition members as terrorists and blocking their financial resources under an anti-terrorism law. She was instrumental, the Treasury Department noted, for enabling the Ortega Murillo regime not only to steal real property owned by political prisoners, but also by independent media outlets and international organizations. In a separate statement, State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller observed that Morales Urbina is responsible for the closing of over 3,500 civil society organizations, including over 250 evangelical groups. She also took part, he said, in the Ortega Murillo regime's baseless attacks on religious institutions, which included false charges and unjust detention of religious leaders. The designation means that any property of Morales Urbina in the United States is blocked, and U.S. persons are banned from business transactions with her. Morales Urbina has been Attorney General in Nicaragua since 2019. In 2018, there were mass protests against the Ortega Murillo government that were brutally repressed by the authorities. Since then, as a February 2024 report by UN human rights experts attests, repression by the government has grown to include large swaths of society, with a focus on incapacitating any kind of opposition in the long term. The United States is determined to hold accountable those in the Nicaraguan regime who are trampling on the rights of the Nicaraguan people. Daniel Ortega, Rosario Murillo, and more than 100 Nicaraguan officials in Nicaragua's political and judicial systems have already been sanctioned by the United States. With the designation of the Attorney General, the United States demonstrates that it remains firmly committed to act against Nicaragua's anti-democratic actors and human rights abusers.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.